Radio.
Religious Freedom and Talking About Marriage in Tasmania. A presentation by Archbishop Julian Porteous.
Thank you very much, Michael. Christianity has really been integral to the development of our Western civilization as we know it. And the Western legal tradition, which really developed in the 12th century, has been heavily influenced by Catholic thinking and Catholic teaching. Some of the principles in law which we accept so readily today are explicitly based in a Christian understanding of the nature of human life, the nature of the human person. In our system of law, justice requires the recognition of intention and incorporates the notion of good faith. A key legal principle that our judicial system recognises is the reciprocity of rights. The Magna Carta of 1215 established the practice of trial by jury, which replaced other practices like trial by ordeal. So many of the laws which we so readily accept today, they find themselves being inspired by a Christian understanding of the nature of justice. Hear the revelation of sacred scripture that God is a just judge is an important and indeed foundational understanding. When one considers the capriciousness of the panoply of gods in the ancient civilizations like Athens and Rome. One particular way in which Christianity has shaped Western government is in the separation of spiritual authority from civil authority. As the Enlightenment philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau noted, prior to the arrival of Christ, spiritual and political authority were vested in one person, the ruler. Ancient rulers understood well the human need for worship, and in order to ensure absolute authority over society, they needed to control both the political and spiritual order. Thus, the Roman Empire required worship of the emperor from its citizens. The claim to absolute authority by political leaders was rejected by Christ. Human authority was revised as limited and subordinated to that of the spiritual order. Yet according to Jesus, the spiritual order did not claim legitimacy to rule the political order, at least not directly. The state had to recognise that there was a transcendent competitor in its quest for authority over citizens. Christians refused to follow instructions or laws to the extent which they conflicted with their religious faith. As a great English lawyer at the moment of his execution under Henry VIII said, "I am the king's good servant, but God's first." One's higher allegiance was to God. A person could not perform any action or follow any command that was in conflict with God's law or the teaching of the church. St. Thomas More, in good conscience, could not accede to the will of Henry VIII when this conflicted with the law of God. Christ liberated the people from enslavement to the absolute authority of earthly rulers. These rulers could no longer go unchallenged and do whatever they wanted. Those who became Christians now gave their first allegiance to God and his transcendent law, to which legislation and the authority of the government were subject. In other words, Christianity provided a fundamental check on unlimited state power. In this way, the church has always, by its nature, resisted totalitarian rulers. And conversely, those seeking absolute power of their authority, of their society, people like Hitler or Stalin, would often go after the church first, or sought to set up their own state churches, or indeed create public events mimicking something like Christian liturgical worship. When Thomas Jefferson crafted the Declaration of Independence on July 4th, 1776, he pointed to certain unalienable rights with which we are endowed by our Creator. These rights are permanent because they have been given by the Creator and not merely allowed by the state. The American founding is premised on the idea of individual rights. The founders were concerned to ensure that government was limited and functioned to serve the people and not the other way around. The protection of individual liberty was of fundamental importance, and the War of Independence was fought to oppose overbearing government. The framers of the Australian Constitution, working in the 1890s, debated the adoption of a Bill of Rights along the same lines as that in the United States. The proposal was not pursued, and our Constitution contains few protections of what we now call human rights. Yet they too share the concern of the American founders. Thus, Section 116 of our Constitution precludes the Commonwealth of Australia from making laws for establishing any religion, imposing any religious observance, or prohibiting the free exercise of any religion. It specifically sought to limit the scope of the federal government's powers. However, are we now witnessing a move to deny the independence of religious bodies? Is there a backdoor denial of religious freedom? The question of freedom of religion in Australian society has become a serious issue in recent times, and Mike gave a very good report on that last night. Several political parties are now calling on the government to remove legislative protections related to religious freedom. They want to subject religion to increasing state oversight and control. We might refer to this as a new totalitarianism. In the recent election campaign, the Tasmanian Green Senator Nick McLean announced that he wanted to change the Tasmanian Anti-Discrimination Act so that churches would lose their exemption from key parts of the law. His view was that, quote, "The fundamental principle here is that Australians should all be treated the same, whether or not they are of one particular religion or another, or whether in fact they are not religious at all," unquote. Religious freedom, particularly for Christians, is under threat in many Western nations at the present time. The rise of an aggressive secular humanism, which ultimately is a form of nihilism, seeks to cobble the freedom of Christians, preventing them from playing an active and contributing role in society. This ascendant ideology seeks to impose itself in an absolute way. It speaks of tolerance and diversity, and yet it seeks to suppress Christianity or yet any belief system that offers an alternative view to their own. They will only allow what is acceptable to them, only that which fits within their own particular view of the human person. They impose their faith on the whole of society while seeking to deny Christians of the basic freedom to express and live according to their faith. They want to replace the guiding role of Christianity has played in Western societies with their own secular faith. Religious communities need to be able to teach what they believe and conduct their activities according to their beliefs. Christianity in particular has proved a major contributor to the stability and flourishing of our society, and we wish to be able to continue to do so. The founders of the American Constitution were charting new waters and identified that the American experiment in popular government would only work if it were grounded in a religiously inspired morality. Thus, Samuel Adams in 1788 said, "Religion and good morals are the only solid foundation of public liberty and happiness." Despite predictions about the growing irrelevance of Christianity in contemporary society, there are clear signs that Christianity is far from a spent force. And the spiritual will always have a key influence in human life. The existence of a transcendental being, the mystery of human existence, determining good and bad, finding final purpose to life, will continue to be the source of religious conviction. The search for the spiritual has always resurfaced after periods of intense persecution, as the sorry story of communism is witnessed. The human spirit seeks meaning and purpose in a relationship with the divine. So religious freedom, properly understood, involves a quest for the truth and requires that governments do not hinder individuals in the pursuit of this truth. By respecting this freedom, the civil authority acknowledges that such ultimate issues are outside its jurisdiction and that conscience is answerable to a higher authority than the law of the land. Individuals and institutions should be free to pursue the truth, and when they find it, worship according to its demands. Religious freedom is, in fact, the bedrock of all human freedom. It provides a fundamental check on the power of the state. It is a temptation of government, particularly when it denies religious freedom, to become totalitarian. The threat we now face is that a bold and aggressive secularism, which is really a pseudo-religion, will attempt to impose itself in a totalitarian way. This totalitarianism preaches tolerance and diversity, but denies the existence of objective truth and suppresses any claims to truth. So it is, in a way, quite self-contradictory. The freedom of religion, however, is not a freedom to believe whatever you want, whatever makes you feel good. Rather, it's fundamentally about the freedom to pursue the truth and, knowing the truth, to act in accordance with that truth. Authentic freedom or liberty can only exist in relation to truth. It is only through recognizing the transcendent truth and being guided by that truth that authentic freedom can be realized. We must, of course, distinguish between the capacity for choice and authentic freedom. Simply having the capacity for choice and freedom to choose how I live my life is not necessarily authentic freedom. It is what I choose that makes me either free or enslaved. We can sometimes confuse simply being free to make decisions without interference from government as being free. Yet we can use our freedom in such a way as to become enslaved to sin and therefore radically unfree. It is only in choosing to pursue and live in accordance with the truth that we achieve authentic freedom. Justice is fundamental for a society to flourish. This means that individuals must be protected and safe from arbitrary interference by government. Justice is best achieved by the institution of the rule of law and civil liberties. So a person should be protected against forms of persecution and from unjust discrimination. Thus, our Australian society has enacted anti-discrimination legislation. Such laws have been enacted both at the federal and state level. These laws seek to protect people from being treated unjustly due to personal characteristics like race, sex, age, and so on. However, these acts of Parliament have been significantly undermined by the use of a particular concept, the concept of offence. This word is a vague word. It refers to a feeling, doesn't it? A subjective emotional state where one is annoyed or upset by something that is said or done. While motivated, no doubt, by good intentions to ensure fair treatment to all, it has set an unreasonable standard by which to limit behaviour and speech. Offence is ultimately a subjective emotion, which is taken to be offensive by one person, but could be viewed as harmless by another. It depends largely on the state of emotions of the person at the time. A sensitive person is more likely to claim offence than a person who is more personally secure. Should the desire that no one feels offended become the criteria for the exercise of free speech? Salman Rushdie has an interesting comment on this. He says, "The idea that any kind of free society can be constructed in which people will never be offended or insulted is absurd. So too is the notion that people should have the right to call on law to defend them against being offended or insulted. A fundamental decision needs to be made. Do we want to live in a free society or not? Democracy is not a tea party where people sit around making polite conversation. In democracies, people get extremely upset with one another. They argue vehemently about each other's positions. With the rise of secular ideology, there will be the need to courageously speak the inconvenient truth on certain moral issues. It will mean speaking on matters like the nature of marriage, the protection of human life. A person of faith should be able to publicly give expression to what he or she believes in a respectful way, without being shouted down or labelled a bigot. Yes, it is true that some will be offended when what is said is not acceptable to them. The truth is not always convenient or readily accepted. It has the capacity of being seen by some as offensive, though this was not its intent. Offence in itself cannot be considered as a reasonable basis for denying freedom of speech. We must have the freedom to say things in a respectful way that others may not accept. A democratic system needs robust debate, and the voice of the person speaking from religious conviction is essential for the health of our society. However, it's important to note that this is not a justification for anyone to say anything. The line is drawn when speech turns to being libelous or the promotion of hatred or violence towards others. Freedom of speech, properly understood, is about the sincere desire to speak the truth and not the deliberate intention to deceive or to damage the reputation of another or promote violence or hatred. So I'd like now just to conclude with some comments on the situation in Tasmania. The relevant section of the Anti-Discrimination Act in Tasmania, section 17.1, says a person must not engage in any conduct which offends, humiliates, intimidates, insults, or ridicules another person on the basis of various attributes like race, sex, and so on. Section 17.1 offers the widest and most general options for a person to interpret discrimination against them for all the states in Australia. For example, the New South Wales Act, in relation to homosexual persons, speaks of inciting hatred or serious contempt. The Queensland legislation uses the same terms in relation to race, religion, sexuality, and gender identity. What is particularly notable about the Tasmanian law is that it only requires that a person feel offended. Thus, as we have seen, this is a highly subjective matter. What offends one person can be found harmless by another. The law as it stands does not need the alleged offence to be directed against a particular person. In my case, the complainant heard that I had distributed a booklet defending the traditional understanding of marriage and obtained a copy from the internet and then complained about being offended. The book was not even distributed directly to the complainant. The only way to ensure that freedom of speech, respectful speech, is to significantly amend Section 17.1 of our Anti-Discrimination Act. And until this is done, the threat remains that anyone who simply seeks to promote a traditional understanding of, say, marriage, is open to prosecution through the Act. Now, the other day, on the 17th, the Tasmanian government announced that it was proposing a number of changes to the anti-discrimination law. It was proposing to add religious purposes to Section 55, which deals with a public purpose and gives thus an extension to religious purposes to be exempted from claims of discrimination. The government is also strengthening Section 64 of the Act so that unreasonable complaints can be more quickly assessed and dismissed. These are good improvements, and we're happy to see them involved. However, Section 17.1, the government states, will remain the same. This still allows for the very subjective notion of offend to be retained. And I believe it will be necessary to change the wording of Section 17.1. What is important, as many point out, is that the Anti-Discrimination Act clearly and strongly prohibits speech or actions which promote hatred towards any individual or group within society. And this is covered in Section 19 of the Act, and that will remain as it is. Amending Section 17 to remove the subjective terminology, such as the word offends, will in no way lessen protections against hate speech. There is clearly a misinformation campaign that is confusing the issue, claiming that any attempt to amend Section 17 will somehow encourage hate speech. Such an argument is false and mischievous. I believe that Section 17.1 in its current form does not pass, if you like, the pub test. As I visit communities around Tasmania, the people I speak to cannot understand how the teaching that I distributed could be in any sense deemed as offensive. And they are fearful that if I could be cited for simply expressing the well-held view and position of the church on marriage, so could they. The changes outlined by the government, while offering those acting for religious purposes greater protection, will do little for the ordinary person, simply wanting to engage in respectful discussion with others. So Section 17, in its current form, clearly places an unreasonable imposition on our ability to engage in robust but respectful public debate. With the likely prospect of a national plebiscite on marriage in the next 6 to 8 months, I believe it's vitally important that all in Tasmania are able to engage in robust and respectful debate and discussion without the threat of being reported to the Anti-Discrimination Commission. And I believe that unless Section 17.1 is amended, Tasmanians will not feel able to express their deeply held beliefs on the nature of marriage in good faith and in a respectful way. I've received numerous letters and emails from concerned individuals who fear that if they do as I did and speak to others about the importance and significance of marriage for our society, they will end up before the commissioner, facing significant legal costs and possible penalties. We must end this fear so that all can engage in respectful debate on the most important issues facing our society. To conclude, in an address to the American bishops during an ad limina visit in 2012, Pope Benedict commented, "In the light of these considerations, it is imperative that the entire Catholic community in the United States come to realise the grave threats to the Church's public moral witness presented by a radical secularism which finds increasing expression in the political and cultural spheres. The seriousness of these threats needs to be clearly appreciated at every level of ecclesial life. Of particular concern are certain attempts being made to limit the most cherished of American freedoms, the freedom of religion. Many of you have pointed out that concerted efforts have been made to deny the right of conscientious objection on the part of Catholic individuals and institutions with regard to cooperation in intrinsically evil practices. Others have spoken to me about a worrying tendency to reduce religious freedom to mere freedom of worship without the guarantees of respect for freedom of conscience. Respecting and preserving freedom of religion will be one of the defining issues of the time ahead in Australia. As those who are pushing for a social reconstruction devoid of Christian morality demand total adherence to the new order, Christians will find themselves denied freedom of speech and will be persecuted in various ways. We will have to pay a price for holding to the truth about the human person and about the character of human society. freedom of religion and freedom of speech are the new challenge that Western parliamentary democracy in Australia is going to have to face. And for the sake of our nation, I hope and pray that freedom will be defended. Thank you.
That was Archbishop Julian Porteous with Religious Freedom and Talking About Marriage in Tasmania. This paper was presented at the 2016 Religious Liberty Conference entitled Varieties of Diversity, hosted by the School of Law, Sydney, at the University of Notre Dame, Australia. For more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.